construction trailer. In a fleeting moment of dread, Officer Delenko wondered if it was already the next night. Was it possible he'd accidentally slept through the whole day? Just then, something smacked against the squad car. Pow! Then came another smack, and another after that. A steady, invisible pounding. Officer Delenko grabbed for his gun, but it wouldn't come out of his holster. The seatbelt was in the way. As he struggled to unstrap himself, the car door flew open, and a white blast of sunlight hit him in the face. He shielded his eyes, and remembering what they'd taught him at the academy, shouted, "Police officer! Police officer!" "Yeah, could have fooled me." It was Curly, the sullen construction foreman. "What's the matter? Didn't you hear me knocking?" Officer Delenko tried to gather his senses. "Guess I fell asleep. Did something happen?" Curly sighed. "Get out and see for yourself." The patrolman emerged into the glaring daylight. "Oh, no," he muttered. "Oh, yeah," Curly said. While Officer Delenko had been dozing, somebody had sprayed all the windows of his squad car with black paint. "What time is it?" he asked Curly.
9:30.
Officer Delenko let out an involuntary whimper. 9:30. He touched his finger to the windshield. The paint was dry. "My car," he said despondently.
"Your car?"
Curly bent down and scooped up an armful of dug-up survey stakes.
"Who cares about your stupid car?"
he said. Roy spent the morning with a knot in his stomach. Something had to be done. Something decisive. He couldn't spend the rest of the school year hiding from Dana Matherson and Beatrice Leap. Dana could be dealt with later, but Beatrice the Bear couldn't wait. At lunchtime, Roy spotted her across the cafeteria. She was sitting with three other girls from the soccer team. They looked lanky and tough, though not as formidable as Beatrice. Taking a deep breath, Roy walked over and sat at the same table. Beatrice glared in seething disbelief while her friends regarded him with amusement and kept eating.
"What is your problem?" Beatrice demanded.
In one hand was a barbecued pork sandwich suspended between the tray and her sneering mouth.
"I think you're the one with the problem,"
Roy smiled, even though he was nervous. Beatrice's soccer friends were impressed. They set down their forks and waited to see what was coming next. Roy plowed ahead.
"Beatrice," he began, "I've got no idea why you're mad about what happened on the bus. You're not the one who got choked, and you're not the one who got punched in the nose. So I'm only going to say this once. If I did something to upset you, I'm sorry. It wasn't on purpose."
Evidently, no one had ever spoken to Beatrice so forthrightly, for she appeared to be in a state of shock. Her sandwich remained fixed in midair, the barbecue sauce trickling down her fingers.
"How much do you weigh?"
Roy asked, not unpleasantly.
"What? Huh?"
Beatrice stammered.
"Well, I weigh exactly 94 pounds,
Roy said,
"and I'll bet you're at least 105.
One of Beatrice's friends giggled, and Beatrice shot her a scowl.
"Which means you could probably knock me around the cafeteria all day long, but it wouldn't prove a darn thing," Roy said. "Next time you've got a problem, just tell me, and then we'll sit down and talk about it like civilized human beings, okay?"
"Civilized?" Beatrice repeated, gazing at Roy over the rims of her glasses. Roy's eyes flickered to her hand, which was now dripping fat globs of barbecue sauce. Soggy chunks of bun and meat were visible between clenched fingers. She had squeezed the sandwich so ferociously that it had disintegrated. One of the soccer girls leaned close to Roy.
"Listen, Mouth, you best get out of here while you can. This is so not cool."
Roy stood up calmly.
"Beatrice, are we straight on this? If anything's bothering you, now's the time to tell me."
Beatrice the Bear dropped the remains of her sandwich on the plate and wiped her hands with a wad of paper napkins. She didn't say a word.
"Whatever."
Roy made a point of smiling again. "I'm glad we had this chance to get to know each other a little better." Then he walked to the other side of the cafeteria and sat down, alone, to eat his lunch. Garrett snuck into his mother's office and copied the address off the master enrollment sheet. It cost Roy a buck.
Roy handed the piece of paper to his mother as they were riding home in the car.
I need to stop here, he told her.
Mrs. Eberhardt glanced at the paper and said, All right, Roy, it's on our way.
She assumed the address belonged to one of Roy's friends and that he was picking up a textbook or a homework assignment.
As they pulled into the driveway of the house, Roy said, This'll only take a minute. I'll be right back.
Dana Matherson's mother answered the door. She looked a lot like her son, which was unfortunate.
Dana home? Roy asked.
Who are you?
I go to school with him.
Mrs. Matherson grunted, turned around, and yelled Dana's name. Roy was glad that she didn't invite him inside. Soon he heard heavy footsteps, and Dana himself filled the doorway. He wore long blue pajamas that would have fit a polar bear. A mound of thick gauze, cross-hatched by shiny white tape, occupied the center of his piggish face. Both eyes were badly swollen and ringed with purple bruising. Roy stood speechless. It was hard to believe that one punch had done so much damage. Dana glared down at him and in a pinched nasal voice said,
I am not believing this.
Don't worry, I just came to give you something.
Roy handed him the envelope containing the apology letter.
What is it?
Dana asked suspiciously.
Go ahead and open it.
Dana's mother appeared behind him.
Who is he? She asked Dana. What's he want?
Never mind,
Dana mumbled.
Roy piped up. I'm the one your son tried to strangle the other day. I'm the one who slugged him.
Dana's shoulders stiffened. His mother clucked in amusement.
You gotta be kidding. This little twerp is the one who messed up your face?
I came to apologize. It's all in the letter. Roy pointed at the envelope clutched in Dana's right hand.
Let me see.
Mrs. Matherson reached over her son's shoulder, but he pulled away and crumpled the envelope in his fist.
Get lost, cowgirl,
he snarled at Roy.
Me and you will settle up when I get back to school.
When Roy returned to the car, his mother asked,
Why are those two people wrestling on the porch?
The one in the pajamas is the kid who tried to choke me on the bus. The other one, that's his mother. They're fighting over my apology letter.
Oh.
Mrs. Eberhardt thoughtfully watched the strange scene through the car window.
I hope they don't hurt each other. They're both rather husky, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Can we go home now, Mom?
5. Roy zipped through his homework in an hour. When he came out of his room, he heard his mother talking to his father on the phone. She was saying that Trace Middle had decided not to take disciplinary action against Dana Matherson because of his injuries. Apparently, the school didn't want to provoke Dana's parents in case they were considering a lawsuit. When Mrs. Eberhardt began telling Mr. Eberhardt about the wild tussle between Dana and his mother, Roy slipped out the back door. He wheeled his bicycle from the garage and rode off. 20 minutes later, he arrived at Beatrice Leap's bus stop, and from there, he easily retraced Friday's ill-fated foot chase. When Roy got to the golf course, he locked his bike to the pipes of a water fountain and set off jogging down the same fairway where he'd gotten clobbered. It was late in the afternoon, steamy hot, and few golfers were out. Nonetheless, Roy ran with his head down and one arm upraised for deflection in case another errant ball came flying in his direction. He slowed only when he reached the stand of Australian pines into which the running boy had vanished. The pine trees gave way to a tangled thicket of Brazilian peppers and dense ground scrub, which looked impenetrable. Roy scoured the fringes looking for a trail or some human sign. He didn't have much time before it would get dark. Soon he gave up trying to locate an entry point and elbowed his way into the pepper trees, which scraped his arms and poked his cheeks. He shut his eyes and thrashed onward. Gradually, the branches thinned and the ground beneath him began to slope. He lost his balance and went sliding down a ditch that ran like a tunnel through the thicket. There in the shadows, the air was cool and earthy. Roy spotted a series of charred rocks encircling a layer of ashes, a campfire. He knelt by the small pit and studied the packed dirt around it. He counted half a dozen identical impressions, all made by the same set of bare feet. Roy placed his own shoe beside one of the prints and wasn't surprised to see they were about the same size. On a whim, he called out, "Hello? You there?" No answer. Slowly, Roy worked his way along the ditch, hunting for more clues. Concealed beneath a mat of vines, he found three plastic garbage bags, each tied at the neck. Inside the first bag was common everyday trash, soda bottles, soup cans, potato chip wrappers, apple cores. The second bag held a stack of boys' clothing, neatly folded t-shirts, blue jeans, and underpants. But no socks or shoes, Roy observed. Unlike the other bags, the third one wasn't full. Roy loosened the knot and peeked, but he couldn't see what was inside. Whatever it was felt bulky. Without thinking, he turned the bag over and dumped the contents on the ground. A pile of thick brown ropes fell out. Then the ropes began to move. "Uh-oh," Roy said. Snakes. And not just any old snakes. They had broad, triangular heads like the prairie rattlers back in Montana, but their bodies were muck-colored and ominously plump. Roy recognized the snakes as cottonmouth moccasins, highly poisonous. They carried no rattles to warn in advance of a strike, but Roy saw that the tips of their stubby tails had been dipped in blue and silver sparkles, the kind used in art projects. It was a most peculiar touch. Roy struggled to remain motionless while the fat reptiles untangled themselves at his feet. Tongues flicking, some of the moccasins extended to their full lengths while others coiled sluggishly. Roy counted 9 in all. "This isn't good," he thought. He almost leaped out of his sneakers when a voice spoke out from the thicket behind him. "Don't move," the voice commanded. "I wasn't planning to," Roy said. "Honest." When he lived in Montana, Roy once hiked up Pine Creek Trail into the Absarica Range, which overlooks Paradise Valley and the Yellowstone River. It was a school field trip with 4 teachers and about 30 kids. Roy had purposely dropped to the rear of the line, and when the others weren't looking, he peeled away from the group. Abandoning the well-worn path, he angled back and forth up the side of a wooded ridge. His plan was to cross over the top and quietly sneak down ahead of the school hikers. He thought it would be funny if they trudged into the campsite and found him napping by the creek. Hurriedly, Roy made his way through a forest of towering lodgepole pines. The slope was littered with brittle dead logs and broken branches, the debris of many cold, windy winters. Roy stepped gingerly to avoid making noise, for he didn't want the hikers down below to hear him climbing. As it turned out, Roy was too quiet. He walked into a clearing and found himself facing a large grizzly bear with 2 cubs. It was impossible to say who was more startled. Roy had always wanted to see a grizzly in the wild, but his buddies at school told him to dream on. Maybe in Yellowstone Park, they said, but not up here. Most grown-ups spent their whole lives out west without ever laying eyes on one. Yet there was Roy, and 100 feet across the glade were 3 serious bears, snorting, huffing, rising on their hind legs to scope him out. Roy remembered that his mother had packed a canister of pepper spray in his backpack, but he also remembered what he'd read about bear encounters. The animals had poor eyesight, and the best thing for a human to do was remain perfectly still and silent. So that's what Roy did. The sow bear squinted and growled and sniffed for his scent on the wind. Then she made a sharp coughing noise, and her cubs obediently dashed off into the woods. Roy swallowed hard, but he didn't move. The mother bear rose to her full height, bared her yellow teeth, and faked a lunge toward him. Inside, Roy was quaking with terror, but on the outside he remained calm and motionless. The bear studied him closely. Her changing expression suggested to Roy that she'd figured out he was too meek and puny to pose a threat. After a few tense moments, she dropped to all 4s and, with a final defiant snort, lumbered off to collect her cubs. Still, Roy didn't move a muscle. He didn't know how far the bears had gone or whether they might come back to stalk him. For 2 hours and 22 minutes, Roy remained as stationary as a plaster statue on that mountainside until one of his teachers found him and led him safely back to the group. So Roy was extremely good at not moving, especially when he was scared. He was plenty scared now, with 9 venomous snakes crawling around his feet.
"Take a deep breath," advised the voice behind him.
"I'm trying," Roy said.
"Okay, now step backwards real slow, on the count of 3.
"Oh, I don't think so," said Roy.
1.
"Now wait a second."
2.
"Please," Roy begged.
3.
"I can't."
3,
the voice said again. Roy's legs felt like rubber as he teetered backward. A hand seized his shirt and yanked him into the thicket of pepper trees. As Roy's butt landed in the dirt, a hood came down over his face and his arms were jerked behind his back. Before he could react, a rope was looped twice around his wrists and secured to the trunk of a tree. Roy could feel the smooth, sticky bark when he wiggled his fingers.
"What's going on?" he demanded.
"You tell me."
The voice had moved in front of him.
"Who are you? Why are you here?"
"My name is Roy Eberhart. I saw you run by the school bus the other day."
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"On 2 different days, actually," Roy said. "I saw you running and I got curious. You look kind of, I don't know, wired."
"Wasn't me."
"Yeah, it was."
The snake wrangler was using a false, husky tone, the voice of a boy trying to sound like a grown-up. Roy said,
"Honest, I didn't come out here to hassle you. Take off this hood so we can see each other, okay?"
He could hear the boy's breathing. Then,
"You're gonna have to get out of here, like right now."
"But what about the snakes?"
"They're mine."
"Yeah, but..."
"They won't go far. I'll catch them again later."
Roy said, "That's not what I meant." The boy laughed.
"Don't worry. I'll take you out the back way. Just do as I say and you won't get bit."
"What a guy," muttered Roy. The boy untied him from the Brazilian pepper and boosted him to his feet.
"I gotta admit, you did pretty good," the boy said. "Most kids would have peed their pants."
"Are those cottonmouths?" Roy asked.
"Yep."
The boy sounded pleased that Roy knew what kind of snakes they were. "Where I used to live, we had lots of rattlers," Roy volunteered. He thought that if he could start a friendly conversation, the kid might change his mind and take the hood off Roy's face. "I never heard of a cottonmouth with sparkles on its tail."
"They're going to a party. Now start walking."
The boy grabbed Roy from behind and guided him forward. He had a strong grip. "I'll tell you when to duck for branches," he said. The hood was either black or dark blue, and Roy couldn't see a speck of light through the heavy fabric. Blindly, he stumbled and swayed through the thicket, but the barefoot boy kept him from falling. Roy knew they were out of the trees when the air got warmer and the ground beneath his feet got flat. He could smell the fertilized sod of the golf course. Soon they stopped marching, and the kid began to loosen the knots on Roy's wrists.
"Don't turn around," he said.
"What's your name?" Roy asked.
"I don't have a name no more."
"Sure you do. Everybody's got a name." The kid grunted.
"I've been called Mullet Fingers, and I've been called worse."
"You don't really live out here, do you?"
"None of your business. What if I do?"
"All by yourself? What about your family?" Roy asked. The boy rapped him lightly on the back of the head.
"You ask too many nosy questions."
"Sorry." Roy noticed his hands were free, but he continued to hold them behind his back.
"Don't turn around until you count to 50, the kid instructed him. "Otherwise, you're going to wake up one morning with one of those big old cottonmouths in your bed. Got it?"
Roy nodded.
"Good. Now start counting."
1, 2, 3, 4, Roy said aloud. When he reached 50, he whipped the hood off his head and wheeled around. He was alone in the middle of the driving range, surrounded by acres of golf balls. The barefoot boy was gone again. Roy ran all the way back to his bicycle and rode home as fast as he could. He wasn't frightened, and he wasn't discouraged. He was more excited than ever. 6. At breakfast the next morning, Roy asked if it was against the law for a kid his age not to go to school. His mother said, "Well, I'm not sure if it's an actual law, but..." "Oh, yes, it is," his father cut in. "Truancy is what it's called." "Can they put you in jail?" Roy asked. "Usually they just put you back in school," Mr. Eberhardt said. Half jokingly, he added, "You weren't thinking of dropping out, were you?" Roy said no, school was all right. "I bet I know what this is about," Mrs. Eberhardt said. "You're worried about bumping into that Matherson boy again. See, didn't I tell you the apology letter was too assertive?" "The letter was just fine," Roy's father said, spreading open the newspaper. "If it was just fine, then why is Roy so scared? Why is he talking about dropping out of school?" "I'm not scared," Roy said, "and I don't want to drop out of Trace Middle. It's just..." His mother eyed him. "What?" "Nothing, Mom." Roy decided not to tell his parents about his encounter with Mullet Fingers, the running boy. Being in law enforcement, Roy's father probably was required to report all crimes, even truancy. Roy didn't want to get the kid in trouble. "Listen to this," Mr. Eberhardt said, and began reading aloud from the newspaper. "A Coconut Cove police cruiser was vandalized early Monday morning while parked at a construction site on East Oriole Avenue. The officer had fallen asleep inside the car at the time, according to a police spokesperson." "Can you believe that?" Roy's mother clucked. "Sleeping on duty? That's disgraceful. They should fire that fellow." Roy thought the story was pretty amusing. "It gets better," his father said. "Listen. The incident happened shortly before sunrise when an unknown prankster sneaked up to the patrol car, a 2001 Crown Victoria, and spray-painted the windows with black paint." Roy, who had a mouthful of raisin bran, burst out laughing. Milk dribbled down his chin. Mr. Eberhardt was also smiling as he continued, "Coconut Cove Police Chief Merle Deacon declined to release the name of the officer who fell asleep, saying that he is part of a special surveillance team investigating property crimes on the east side of town. Deacon said the officer had recently been ill with the flu and had been given medication that made him drowsy." Roy's father looked up from the article. "Medication. Ha!" "What else does the story say?" Mrs. Eberhardt asked. "Let's see. It says this was the third suspicious incident within a week at this location, which is the future home of a Mother Paula's All-American Pancake House." Roy's mother brightened. "We're getting a Mother Paula's here in Coconut Cove? That'll be nice." Roy swabbed a napkin across his chin. "Dad, what else happened out there?"
"I was wondering the same thing." Mr. Eberhardt skimmed the rest of the article. "Here it is. Last Monday, unknown intruders uprooted survey stakes from the property. 4 days later, vandals entered the site and placed live alligators in 3 portable toilets. According to police, the reptiles were captured unharmed and later released into a nearby canal. No arrests have been made." Mrs. Eberhardt rose and started clearing the breakfast dishes.
"Alligators?" she said. "Good heavens, what next?"
Mr. Eberhardt folded the paper and tossed it on the kitchen counter. "This is turning out to be an interesting little town after all, isn't it, Roy?" Roy picked up the newspaper to see for himself. East Oriole Avenue sounded familiar. As he read the story, Roy remembered where he had seen that street sign. Beatrice Leap's bus stop, the place he had first spotted the running boy, was on West Oriole Avenue, just the other side of the main highway. "The article doesn't say how big those gators were," Roy remarked. His father chuckled. "I don't think that's important, son. I think it's the thought that counts." The police captain said, "I've read your report, David. Is there anything else you'd like to add?" Officer Delinko shook his head. His hands were folded on his lap. What could he say? His sergeant spoke up.
"David understands how serious this is."
"Embarrassing's the word," the captain said.
"The chief has been sharing some of the emails and phone messages with me. It's not pretty. Did you see the newspaper?"
Officer Delinko nodded. He had read and reread the article 12 times. Each time it made his stomach churn.
You probably noticed that your name wasn't mentioned, the captain said. That's because we refused to release it to the media.
Yes, thank you, Officer Delinko said. I'm very sorry about all this, sir.
And you read Chief Deacon's explanation for what happened? I assume you're comfortable with that?
To be honest, sir, I haven't had the flu, and I wasn't taking any medication yesterday.
David, the sergeant cut in. If the chief says you were taking flu medicine, you were definitely taking flu medicine. And if the chief says that's why you fell asleep in your patrol car, then that's exactly what happened. Understand?
Oh, yes, sir.
The captain held up a yellow slip of paper. This is a bill from the Ford dealership for $410. They got that black paint off your windows. That's the good news. Took them all day, but they did it.
Officer Delinko was sure that the captain was going to hand him the repair bill, but he didn't. Instead, he placed it inside the patrolman's personal file, which lay open on his desk.
Officer, I don't know what to do with you. I just don't.
The captain's tone was one of paternal disappointment.
I'm very sorry. It won't happen again, sir.
Officer Delinko's sergeant said,
Captain, I ought to tell you that David volunteered for this surveillance duty at the construction site. And he went out early in the morning, on his own off-duty time.
His own time? The captain folded his arms. Well, that's commendable. David, can I ask you why you did that?
Because I wanted to catch the perpetrators, Officer Delinko replied. I knew it was a priority with you and the chief.
That's the only reason? You didn't have some sort of personal stake in this case?
I do now, thought Officer Delinko, now that they've made a fool of me.
No, sir, he said. The captain turned his attention toward the sergeant.
Well, there's got to be some type of punishment, whether we like it or not. The chief's taking too much grief over this.
I agree, the sergeant said.
Officer Delinko's heart sank. Any disciplinary action would automatically become part of his permanent record. It might be an issue when it came time for a promotion.
Sir, I'll pay that bill myself, Officer Delinko offered.
$410 was a serious chunk out of his paycheck, but keeping his record spotless was worth every penny. The captain said it wasn't necessary for Officer Delinko to cover the bill, and that wouldn't satisfy the chief anyway.
So I'm putting you on desk duty, he said, for a month.
David can live with that, said the sergeant.
But what about the Mother Paula surveillance? Officer Delinko asked.
Don't worry, we'll get it covered. Somebody off the midnight shift.
Yes, sir.
Officer Delinko was depressed at the idea of being stuck behind a desk, doing nothing for a whole boring month. Still, it was better than being suspended. The only thing worse than sitting at headquarters would be sitting at home. The captain stood up, which meant the meeting was over. He said,
David, if anything like this ever happens again...
It won't, I promise.
Next time you're definitely going to see your name in the newspaper.
Yes, sir.
Under a headline that says, Officer Terminated. Is that clear?
Officer Delinko cringed inwardly.
I understand, sir, he said quietly to the captain.
He wondered if the little jerks who sprayed his Crown Victoria realized how much trouble they were getting him into.
My whole career is in jeopardy, Officer Delinko thought angrily, all because of some smart-ass juvenile delinquents.
He was more determined than ever to catch them in the act. In the hallway outside the captain's office, the sergeant told him,
You can pick up your car at the motor pool, but remember, David, you're off-road patrol. That means you're allowed to drive the unit home and back, but that's all.
Right, said Officer Delinko. Home and back. He had already thought of a route that would take him directly past the corner of East Oriole and Woodbury, the future location of Mother Paula's All-American Pancake House. Nobody said he couldn't leave his house extra early in the morning. Nobody said he couldn't take his sweet time getting to work.
Dana Matherson was absent from school again. Roy felt somewhat relieved, though not enough to relax. The longer Dana had to stay away so his nose could recover from Roy's punch, the nastier he would be when he finally returned to Trace Middle.
You still got time to blow town, Garrett suggested helpfully.
I'm not running away. Whatever happens just happens.
Roy wasn't trying to act cool. He'd thought a lot about the Dana situation. Another confrontation seemed inevitable, and part of him simply wanted to get it over with. He wasn't cocky, but he had a stubborn streak of pride,
He had no intention of spending the rest of the year cowering in the restroom or sneaking through the halls just to avoid some dumb bully.
"I probably shouldn't tell you this," said Garrett, "but some of the kids are taking bets."
"Great. They're betting on whether Dana's going to beat me up?"
"No, on how many times he's going to beat you up."
"Nice," Roy said.
Actually, two good things had come out of the altercation with Dana Matherson. The first was Roy successfully tailing the barefoot boy to the golf course. The second was Roy being booted off the bus for 2 weeks by the vice principal. It was nice having his mother pick him up at school. They got to chat in the car, and Roy arrived home 20 minutes earlier than usual. The phone was ringing when they walked in the door. It was his mother's sister calling from California to chat. Roy seized the opportunity to retrieve a cardboard shoebox from his room and slip quietly out the back door of the house. He was heading for the golf course again, with a slight detour. Instead of making a left on West Oriole toward the bus stop, Roy rode his bicycle across the highway to East Oriole. He'd gone less than 2 blocks when he came upon a scrub-covered lot with a dented work trailer in one corner. Parked beside the trailer was a blue pickup truck. Not far away sat 3 bulldozer-type vehicles and a row of portable toilets. Roy figured this had to be the same place where the police car got spray-painted and the alligators were hidden inside the latrines. As soon as Roy stopped his bicycle, the door of the trailer flew open and a stocky, bald man charged out. He wore stiff tan work pants and a tan shirt that had a name stitched to the breast. Roy was too far away to read it.
"What do you want?"
the man snapped, his face flushed with anger.
"Hey, kid, I'm talking to you."
Roy thought, what's his problem? The man came toward him, pointing.
"What's in that box?"
he yelled.
"What have you and your little buddies got planned for tonight, huh?"
Roy spun his bike around and started pedaling away. The guy was acting like a total psycho.
"That's right, and don't you come back,"
the bald man hollered, shaking a fist.
"Next time there'll be guard dogs waiting for you. The meanest damn dogs you ever saw."
Roy pedaled faster. He didn't turn around. The clouds were darkening, and he thought he felt a raindrop on one cheek. From the distance came a rumble of thunder. Even after crossing the highway to West Oriole, Roy didn't slow his pace. By the time he made it to the golf course, a steady drizzle was coming down. He hopped off his bicycle and, shielding the shoebox with both arms, began to jog across the deserted greens and fairways. Soon he reached the thicket of pepper trees where he'd encountered the boy called Mullet Fingers. Roy had mentally prepared himself to be blindfolded and tied up again. He'd even composed a short speech for the occasion. He was determined to persuade Mullet Fingers that he was someone to be trusted, that he hadn't come to interfere, but rather to help, if Mullet Fingers needed it. While working his way through the thicket, Roy grabbed a dead branch off the ground. It was heavy enough to make an impression on a cottonmouth moccasin, though he hoped that wouldn't be necessary. When he got to the ditch, he saw no signs of the deadly sparkle-tailed snakes. The running boy's camp was gone, cleaned out. All the plastic bags had been removed, and the fire pit had been buried. Roy poked the tip of the dead branch through the loose dirt, but it yielded no clues. Glumly, he checked for footprints and found not one. Mullet Fingers had fled without a trace. As Roy emerged into the fairway, the purple sky opened up. Rain slashed down in wind-driven sheets that stung his face, and lightning crashed ominously nearby. Roy shivered and took off running. In an electrical storm, the worst place to be was on a golf course, standing near trees. As he ran, flinching at every thunderclap, he began to feel guilty about sneaking away from the house. His mother would be worried sick once she realized he was out in this weather. She might even get in the car and come searching for him, a prospect that troubled Roy. He didn't want his mom driving around in such dangerous conditions. The rain was so heavy that she wouldn't be able to see the road very well. As wet and weary as he was, Roy forced himself to run faster. Squinting through the downpour, he kept thinking, "It can't be much farther." He was looking for the water fountain where he'd left his bicycle. Finally, as another wild burst of lightning illuminated the fairway, he spotted it 20 yards ahead of him. But his bicycle wasn't there. At first, Roy thought it was the wrong fountain. He thought he must have lost his direction in the storm.
Then he recognized a nearby utility shed and a wooden kiosk with the soda machine. This was the place, all right. Roy stood in the rain and stared miserably at the spot where he'd left his bike. Usually he was careful about locking it, but today he'd been in too much of a hurry. Now it was missing. Stolen, undoubtedly. To get away from the rain, Roy dashed into the wooden kiosk. The soggy cardboard box was coming apart in his hands. It would be a very long walk home, and Roy knew he couldn't get there before nightfall. His parents would be going bananas. For 10 minutes, Roy stood in the kiosk, dripping on the floor, waiting for the downpour to slacken. The lightning and thunder seemed to be rolling eastward, but the rain just wouldn't quit. Finally, Roy stepped outside, lowered his head, and started trudging in the direction of his neighborhood. Every step made a splash. Raindrops streaked down his forehead and clung to his eyelashes. He wished he'd worn a cap. When he got to the sidewalk, he tried to run, but it was like sloshing through the shallows of an endless lake. Roy had noticed this about Florida. It was so low and flat that puddles took forever to drain. He plodded onward, and soon he reached the bus stop where he'd first spotted the running boy. Roy didn't pause to look around. It was growing darker by the minute. Just as he made it to the corner of West Oriole and the highway, the streetlights flickered on. Oh, brother, he thought. I'm really late. Traffic was steady in both directions, creeping through the standing water. Roy waited impatiently. Every car pushed a wake that splashed against his shins. He didn't care. He was already soaked to the bone. Spying a gap in the traffic, Roy ventured into the road. Watch it! Shouted a voice behind him. Roy jumped back on the curb and spun around. There was Beatrice Leap, sitting on his bicycle. She said, What's in the shoebox, cowgirl? 7. How it happened was no big mystery. Like all students, Beatrice the Bear lived in the vicinity of her school bus stop. Roy likely had ridden right past her front door, and when Beatrice had spotted him, she simply tailed him to the golf course. That's my bike, he said to her. Yeah, it is. Can I have it back? Maybe later, she said. Hop on. What? The handlebars, you dork. Get on the handlebars. We're going for a ride. Roy did what he was told. He wanted to retrieve his bicycle and go home. 2 years of pushing up and down high hills in Montana's thin air had made Roy a powerful rider. But Beatrice Leap was stronger. Even through deep puddles, she pedaled swiftly and effortlessly, as if Roy were weightless. Perched uncomfortably on the handlebars, he clutched the sodden cardboard box. Where are we going? He shouted. Hush up, Beatrice said. She steamed past the fancy brick entrance to the golf course, and soon the paved road gave way to a dirt rut with no curbs or streetlights. Roy braced himself as the bike jounced through muddy potholes. The rain had softened to a mist, and his wet shirt felt cool against his skin. Beatrice stopped when they came to a tall chain-link fence. Roy observed that a small section had been cut with wire clippers so that it could be pulled back. He got off the handlebars and tugged at his jeans, which had ridden up the crack of his butt. Beatrice parked the bicycle and motioned for Roy to follow her through the hole in the fence. They entered a junkyard full of wrecked automobiles. Acres of them. In the twilight, Roy and Beatrice crept along, darting from one rusted hulk to the next. From the way Beatrice was acting, Roy assumed they weren't alone on the property. Soon they came to an old panel truck propped up on cinder blocks. Roy could barely make out the faded red lettering on its battered awning. JoJo's Ice Cream and Snow Cones. Beatrice Leap stepped up into the cab, pulling Roy behind her. She led him through a narrow doorway into the back, which was cluttered with crates, boxes, and heaps of clothes. Roy noticed a sleeping bag rolled up in a corner. When Beatrice closed the door, they were in total darkness. Roy couldn't see his own fingers in front of his face. He heard Beatrice's voice. "Let me have your box." "No," Roy said. "Eberhard, are you fond of your front teeth?" "I'm not afraid of you," Roy lied. It was stuffy and humid inside the old ice cream truck. Mosquitoes hummed in Roy's ears, and he slapped at them blindly. He smelled something that seemed out of place, something oddly familiar. Cookies? The truck smelled like freshly baked peanut butter cookies, the kind Roy's mother made. The piercing beam of the flashlight caught him squarely in the eyes, and he turned away. "For the last time," Beatrice said menacingly, "what's in that shoebox?"
"Shoes," said Roy.
"I'm so sure."
"Honest."
She snatched the box from his hands and flipped it open, aiming the flashlight at the contents.
"I told you," Roy said.
Beatrice huffed.
"Why are you carrying around an extra pair of sneakers? That's really weird, cowgirl."
"The shoes aren't for me," Roy said. They were almost brand new. He'd only worn them a couple of times.
"Then who are they for?"
"Just a kid I met."
"What kid?"
"The one I told you about at school. The one who went running by your bus stop that day."
"Oh," Beatrice said caustically. "The one you went chasing when you should have been minding your own business?"
She turned the flashlight off and everything went black again.
"Well, I finally met him."
"Sort of," Roy said.
"You don't give up, do you?"
"Look, the kid needs shoes. He could step on broken glass or rusty nails, or even a cotton mouth."
"How do you know he wants to wear shoes, Eberhardt? Maybe he can run faster without them."
Roy wasn't sure what Beatrice Leap's problem was, but he knew he was seriously late for dinner, and his parents were probably frantic. He planned to make a break as soon as Beatrice turned on the flashlight again. If he could somehow beat her to the bicycle, he might be able to get away.
"Whatever," Roy said. "If he doesn't want the shoes, I'll keep them myself. If he does, well, they ought to fit him. He looked about as tall as me."
From the darkness, only silence.
"Beatrice, if you're going to beat me up, could you please hurry up and get it over with? My mom and dad are probably calling the National Guard right now."
More heavy silence.
"Beatrice, you awake?"
"Eberhardt, why do you care about this kid?" It was a good question, and Roy wasn't certain he could put the answer into words. There was something about the look on the boy's face when he went running past the school bus those days. Something urgent and determined and unforgettable.
"I don't know," Roy said to Beatrice Leap.
"I don't know why." The flashlight blinked on. Roy clambered for the door, but Beatrice calmly snatched him by the seat of his jeans and yanked him to the floor beside her. Roy sat there panting, waiting to get clobbered. Yet she didn't seem mad.
"What size are these?"
she asked, holding up the sneakers.
9s, said Roy.
In the cupped glow of the light, Beatrice put a finger on her lips and pointed over her shoulder. Then Roy heard the footsteps outside. Beatrice clicked off the light, and they waited. The steps in the gravel sounded heavy and ponderous, like those of a large man. Something jangled as he moved, a set of keys maybe, or loose coins in a pocket. Roy held his breath. As the watchman approached the ice cream truck, he whacked one of the fenders with what sounded like a lead pipe. Roy jumped but made no noise. Luckily, the man kept walking. Every so often, he'd bang the pipe loudly on another junker, as if he were trying to scare something out of the shadows. After the man was gone, Beatrice whispered, "Rent-a-cop."
"What are we doing here?"
Roy asked weakly. In the darkness of the compartment, he could hear Beatrice the Bear standing up.
"Tell you what I'm gonna do, cowgirl," she said. "I'll make you a little deal."
"Go on," said Roy.
"I'll see that the barefoot kid gets these shoes, but only if you promise to leave him alone. No more spying."
"So you do know him?" Beatrice hoisted Roy to his feet.
"Yeah, I know him," she said.
"He's my brother." At 4:30 in the afternoon, when Officer David Delinko normally got off work, his desk was still piled high with paperwork. He had lots of forms to fill out and reports to complete about what had happened to his patrol car. He kept writing until his wrist began to ache, and at 6 he finally called it quits. The motor pool was only a few blocks away, but the rain was pouring down when Officer Delinko wearily came out of the headquarters building. He didn't want his uniform to get drenched, so he waited under the eave, directly beneath the capital P, in Coconut Cove Public Safety Department. Lots of cities had started referring to their police forces as public safety departments, a phrase intended to promote a softer, friendlier image. Like most officers, David Delenko thought the name change was pointless. A cop was a cop, period. In an emergency, nobody ever yelled, "Quick, call the public safety department!" "Call the police," is what they always shouted, and always would. David Delenko was proud to be a policeman. His father had been a robbery detective in Cleveland, Ohio, and his older brother was a homicide detective in Fort Lauderdale. And a detective is what David Delenko fervidly wanted to be someday. That day, he realized sadly, was probably further in the future than ever, thanks to the vandals at the Pancake House construction site. Officer Delenko was mulling his situation, watching the rain stream down, when a lightning bolt zapped a utility pole at the end of the street. Briskly, he retreated into the lobby of the headquarters building, where the ceiling lights flickered twice and faded out. "Ah, shoot," Officer Delenko grumbled to himself. There was nothing to do but wait for the storm to pass. He couldn't stop thinking about the bizarre incidents at the Mother Paula's property. First, somebody pulling the survey stakes, then dumping the alligators in the latrines, then spray-painting his squad car while he was asleep inside. This was the work of bold and defiant perpetrators. Immature, certainly, but still bold. In Officer Delenko's experience, kids weren't usually so persistent or so daring. In typical cases of juvenile vandalism, the crimes could be traced to a group of youngsters, each trying to outdo the other for thrills. But this wasn't a typical case, Officer Delenko thought. Possibly it was the work of just one person with a grudge. Or a mission. After a while, the squall began to subside, and the thunderclouds scudded away from the center of town. Officer Delenko covered his head with a newspaper and made a dash for the motor pool yard. His hand-shined shoes were squirting water by the time he got there. The Crown Victoria, looking as good as new, sat outside the locked gate. Officer Delenko had asked the garage chief to hide the car keys in the gas cap, but instead they were inserted into the ignition, visible to anyone strolling by. The garage chief believed nobody was loony enough to steal a marked police car. Officer Delenko started up the car and headed for his apartment. Along the way, he made a slow loop around the Pancake House property, but there wasn't a soul to be seen. He wasn't surprised. Criminals disliked lousy weather as much as law-abiding citizens did. Even when off duty, Officer Delenko always kept the radio in his police cruiser turned on. That was one of the strict rules for those who were allowed to take their patrol vehicles home with them. You must keep your ears on, just in case a fellow officer needs help. Tonight, the dispatcher was reporting a couple of minor fender benders and a local boy who went missing on his bicycle during the electrical storm. Roy something or other. A burp of static on the radio made it hard to hear the boy's last name. His parents must be pulling their hair out, Officer Delenko thought, but the kid's bound to turn up safe. He's probably just hanging out at one of the shopping malls, waiting for the thunder to stop. 10 minutes later, Officer Delenko was still half thinking about the missing boy when he spotted a slender, rain-soaked figure standing at the corner of West Oriole and the highway. It was a boy matching the description given out by the dispatcher. Approximately 5 feet tall, 90 pounds, sandy brown hair. Officer Delenko steered his car to the curb. He rolled down the window and called out across the intersection.
"Hey, young man!"
The boy waved and moved closer to the edge of the road. Officer Delenko noticed that he was walking a bicycle and that the rear tire appeared to be flat.
"Is your name Roy?"
the policeman asked.
"That's me. How about if I give you a lift?"
The kid crossed the street with his bike, which fit easily inside the spacious trunk of the Crown Victoria. Officer Delenko radioed the dispatcher to report that he'd located the missing youth and that everything was fine.
"Roy, your parents are going to be mighty happy to see you," the patrolman said.
The boy smiled nervously. "I sure hope you're right." Silently, Officer Delenko congratulated himself. Not a bad way to end the shift for a guy stuck on desk duty. Maybe this would help get him out of the captain's doghouse. Roy had never been in a police car before. He rode in the front seat next to the young officer, who did most of the talking.
Roy tried to be polite and keep up his end of the conversation, but his mind was swirling with what Beatrice Leap had told him about the running boy.
"My stepbrother, actually," she said.
"What's his name?"
"He got rid of it."
"Why do they call him Mullet Fingers? Is he an Indian?"
Back in Bozeman, Roy had gone to school with a boy named Charlie Three Crows.
Beatrice Leap had laughed.
"No, he's not an Indian. I call him Mullet Fingers 'cause he can catch mullet with his bare hands. You know how hard that is?"
A mullet was a slippery, free-jumping bait fish that traveled in schools of hundreds. The bay near Coconut Cove was full of them in the spring. Throwing a cast net was the customary method of capture.
"Why doesn't he live at home?" Roy had asked Beatrice.
"Long story, plus none of your business."
"What about school?"
"My brother got shipped off to a special school. He lasted 2 whole days before he ran away. Then he hitchhiked back, all the way from Mobile, Alabama."
"What about your parents?"
"They don't know he's here, and I'm not going to tell them. Nobody is going to tell them, you understand?"
Roy had solemnly given his word. After they sneaked out of the auto junkyard, Beatrice Leap had given Roy a peanut butter cookie, which he gobbled hungrily. Considering the circumstances, it was the best-tasting cookie he'd ever eaten. Beatrice had asked how he planned to explain his whereabouts to his mother and father, and Roy had admitted that he hadn't figured that part out yet. Then Beatrice had performed an astounding feat. She lifted his bicycle by the sprockets and chomped a hole in the rear tire like she was biting into a pizza. Roy could only gape in amazement. The girl had jaws like a wolverine.
"There, now you've got a flat," she said, "and a half-decent excuse for missing dinner."
"Thanks, I guess.
So what are you waiting for? Get out of here."
What a weird family, Roy thought. He was replaying the tire-biting scene in his mind when he heard the policeman say,
"Can I ask you something, young man?"
"Sure.
You go to Trace Middle, right?
I was wondering if you've heard any talk at school about stuff that's been happening out where the new pancake house is supposed to go up."
"No," Roy said, "but I saw an article in the newspaper."
The officer shifted uneasily.
"About the alligators," Roy added,
"and the police car getting spray-painted."
The officer paused for a brief coughing spell. Then he said,
"You sure nobody's been talking about it? Sometimes the kids who pull these sort of pranks like to brag on themselves."
Roy said he hadn't heard a word.
"This is my street," he said, pointing. "We're the 6th house on the left."
The policeman wheeled into the Eberhardt's driveway and braked to a stop.
"Roy, could I ask you a favor? Could you call me if you do hear something? Anything. Even a rumor about the Mother Paula's situation? It's very important."
The officer handed Roy a printed card.
"That's the office line, and that's my cellular."
Above the phone numbers, the card said, "Officer David Delinko, Patrol Division, Coconut Cove Public Safety Department."
"You can call me any time," advised Officer Delinko. "Just keep your eyes and your ears open, okay?"
"Right," Roy said, not too eagerly. The policeman was asking him to be an informant, a snitch on his own classmates. It seemed like a steep price to pay for a ride home. Not that Roy wasn't appreciative, but he didn't feel like he owed the officer anything besides a sincere thank you. Wasn't it part of a policeman's job to help people? Roy got out of the car and waved to his parents, who were standing on the front steps. Officer Delinko removed Roy's bicycle from the trunk and set it upright on its kickstand.
"There you go," he said.
"Thanks," said Roy.
"They'll patch that tire for you at the Exxon. Was it a nail that got you?"
"Something like that." Roy's father came up and thanked the policeman for bringing his son home. Roy overheard the two men exchanging law enforcement chit-chat, so Roy figured his father had told the officer he worked for the Justice Department. When Mr. Eberhardt went to put Roy's bicycle in the garage, Officer Delinko lowered his voice and said,
"Hey, young man."
What now, Roy thought.
"Think your dad would mind writing a letter to the police chief? Or even to my sergeant? No biggie, just a nice note about what happened tonight. Something they could put in my permanent file," Officer Delinko said.
"The little things help, they really do. They add up."
Roy nodded in a noncommittal way.
I'll ask him.
Terrific. You're a solid young fellow. Officer Delenko got back in his car. Mrs. Eberhardt, who had gone inside to get a towel, came up and pumped the patrolman's hand.
We were worried out of our minds. Thank you so much.
Oh, it was nothing. Officer Delenko shot a wink at Roy.